Welcome back to another episode of the CSK8 podcast. My name is Jared O'Leary. Each week of this podcast is either a solo episode where I unpack some scholarship in relation to computer science education, or an episode with a guest or multiple guests. In this week's particular episode, I'm having a conversation with a coworker at Boot Up, and her name is Ashley Waring. In this discussion, we chat about Ashley's experiences with integrating CS in the classroom, lessons learned providing professional development for new to CS educators, what Ashley learned helping write Alabama's CS standards and providing support after the rollout, language and oppression in standards development, why focusing on college degrees as an end goal might not be as important as focusing on lifelong learning, and so much more. As always, there are many links in the show notes that you can find at jaredoleary.com, including a link to bootuppd.org, which is the nonprofit that I work for where I create 100% free coding curriculum. So if you want to dive deeper into any of the resources that are mentioned in this particular episode, such as some of the podcasts that I mentioned, or even some of the books like by James Paul G, make sure you check out the show notes. And with that, we will now begin the interview with Ashley.
I'm Ashley Waring. I'm a Bootup PD facilitator. I also have been working with A+ College Ready and Code.org as a computer science fundamentals facilitator in the state of Alabama for a few years, and I'm excited to be here.
Can you tell me the story of how you got into computer science education?
I'm really close to my family, and I've always kind of come from a close-knit family, and I've always been the like techie of the group. So whenever my parents got a new sound system, or you know, if somebody needed help fixing the printer or couldn't figure out a program, I was always the one to kind of take the lead on that. Because of that, in high school, I took AP CS for about 3 weeks and realized that not only was I the only girl in that class, but I also didn't have any background other than like keyboarding and stuff like that in middle school. So it was just kind of a disconnect there. I ended up doing biology, but fast forward a few years and I was in the classroom, got to jump on integrating Chromebooks in the classroom in a fourth grade general ed class. And with that came an opportunity to take a Code.org PD, and that really sparked my CS education interest. I walked away from that like, why aren't we teaching this as a common literacy to everybody? My mind was just blown after that PD, learning about computational thinking, learning about, you know, the stats behind jobs for my students that still aren't even created yet, you know, and being able to prepare them for that. So not only do they need to read and be able to do some math and, you know, understand some fundamentals of science, but I also walked away from that just really thinking that fundamentals in computer science was another thing that students needed at an elementary level. So from that, I started integrating Code.org into my classroom. So, you know, we might do like a fun code Friday or something like that. And then I started to get more and more into the technical side of CS, I guess, instead of just kind of playing around in puzzles, really thinking about those computational thinking concepts and trying to pull them out in a way that students can kind of solidify those abstract concepts that they can be sometimes. But also had Hour of Code in my classroom, which was an event that Code.org does, and had really awesome success with that, bringing in volunteers from the real world who work in CS, and then got more schools across the district to start participating in Hour of Code with us. And then I got an opportunity to apply to be on the committee for Alabama. The technology standards were up for recertification. I got to be a part of that, and we actually ended up changing the standards from being technology standards to being digital literacy and computer science standards to meet the needs of our students. And we were the 15th state to pass computer science standards for kindergarten through 12th grade. So that's kind of my journey. I've been a STEM teacher since then. I've been a CSF facilitator with Code.org for a few years, like I mentioned, and was also worked at the district level. So I've just kind of taken it and seeing what CS can do in the classroom and run with it, which I didn't really mention, but that was a huge part of why I kept going with integrating CS was I saw it as a great equity tool in the classroom because some of my students who maybe, you know, caught on easily to concepts in traditional academia would struggle a little bit and be able to taste the struggle that they didn't taste in other areas, which I think is great, learning some grit and perseverance. And then also students who didn't have that traditional success got success through those computational thinking skills or through those coding projects. And that kind of trickled into the rest of their education. They got that taste of success and it kind of motivated them in other ways too. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into CS.
So one of the nice things about working at Boot Up is we've had a lot of conversations with other nonprofits and people within the space who are especially doing like professional development and curriculum and whatnot. And one of the interesting things that we've noted is that many providers have difficulty with implementation rate like a year or two after actually having done the workshop and whatnot. It sounded like this really resonated for you and was a very positive experience for you and the kids that you work with. But I'm curious, like from your perspectives, like either as a teacher, as like standards writer or as a PD facilitator, like why do you think it is that so many people end up dabbling in CS and then ultimately drop it after a while?
I think it could be multiple reasons. So I think that having a community when you're a first-time CS teacher is huge. So like other teachers, you can go to and be like, I don't know what this is about. Can you help me figure out what this is about? So kind of being a lead learner in that way, you know, connecting with other people, keeping your mind open to having that support and learning. So, you know, as your students are learning, you're continuing to build your own learning and your connections with others. In certain scenarios, I could see where teachers, you know, the first year students get the basics, get the foundations, and that's what the teacher has a great understanding of. But then when the second year comes around and there's more, you know, deeper problems or deeper projects, deeper coding concepts involved, teachers can be intimidated by that. And if they don't have that support, that team, then maybe they just kind of drop off or it just doesn't become a priority. And another thing could be, you know, do they have support from their admin? Is there an interest in the community? You know, do they have that external support in continuing that learning as well?
So I spent weekends, weeknights, so-called breaks and holidays learning several different languages and just diving deeper into programming and computer science. But I'm wondering, because there wasn't opportunities for me to spend class time or school time to do professional development, basically. I had to do it on my own. And I know most teachers don't have that luxury. Did you have the luxury of being able to learn it on school clock hours, or did you have to kind of teach yourself outside of it?
I think it was a little bit of both. I definitely had that support and interest from admin, from, you know, we had a district initiative. Well, it was STEM based, but CS was a part of that. So I definitely had that support, but I feel like my professional learning was through the school. And like, I was able to have that like during school hours, like, you know, I would have a sub in my classroom and I would be able to go to a PD, that kind of thing. But I feel like the community building was very much outside of my school's realm or support or capabilities, I guess. So I kind of feel like it was two pockets to make it a success.
So one of the things that I really like to ask guests is asking about like kind of something that they believed when they first started in education or CS education that they no longer actually believe in. So kind of having that change in thought over time. Because I myself have like had many things where I'm like, oh yeah, this is awesome, the greatest thing ever. And then I look back on that and go, yeah, I would have done that differently. And I do that differently right now. I'm wondering for you, like what's something that you first believed when you first started working in education or CS education that you no longer believe now?
One that sticks out to me is that I used to think, you know, like I became a new teacher and new teacher, I'm getting my kids ready for college. So I feel like I used to think that every kid needed to be prepared to go to college. And I really don't believe that at all anymore. I feel like some students are going to go to college and do that kind of thing, but other students can graduate from high school and have CS endorsements and get a $60,000 a year job. You know, when I think about that question, I think about like new little teacher Ashley, you know, over at her little school. What did she used to think? And I think about what my perception of equality was then and how I've kind of transitioned into understanding the difference between equality and equity and like seeing those like stark problems across districts just because of where they're located has helped me with that because I've kind of gone from one end of the spectrum to the other in my public ed background and it's not fair, you know, it's not fair. So I think that was a big thing. I just kind of thought that everybody got the same thing because that's what I was taught, you know, but it didn't, you know, I've noticed it's not, it's not. So
yeah, I think once people actually start teaching in multiple different schools and communities, then it makes it easier to see just how drastically different one person's education can be from another.
Yeah, just because of where you grew up, you know, or where you were born or, yeah.
I'm curious about this question. I haven't asked it in a while, but I like asking guests this question. So what's something related to education that you're really good at, or really knowledgeable at, that most people don't know about you?
I love biology. I've always been fascinated by, you know, genetics or osmosis, like anything broadly under biology. I kind of got a spark again for biology when I was a STEM teacher, and I did this virtual reality Google expedition with my students, and it was looking through the eyes of different animals. And like, you know, on one side you could see what we as humans see, on the other side you can see what animals see. I mean, I probably taught that lesson 30 times, 35 times, and every time I was like more excited.
Were you always interested in that subject area? And if not, how did you develop that interest?
So remember, I took AP CS for a minute. When I did drop that, I picked up AP biology instead. So I feel like that's like, I've always been interested or fascinated by, you know, how things work inside, especially things that are not mechanical. You know, like I understand how the computer makes itself work, or, you know, we make the computer make itself work, but it's fascinating to me that ourselves work without being programmed, I guess. So those like natural programs, natural algorithms, natural builds, it's really cool to me.
So if I'm wondering, could you paint a picture of what an ideal CS and learning environment would look like for you?
Yes. Do you have a paintbrush?
In the other room.
So to me, an ideal CS learning environment would be not a quiet place. I mean, you could definitely, I feel like you could sense some, you know, focus and collaboration, but not a quiet place, you know. I think that students in that kind of environment are talking to each other, talking to the teacher. And I feel like the teacher in that environment is a lead learner. So maybe not the person who knows all the answers, but the person who can help find other people who might know the answers. And also modeling, you know, failure is a first attempt in learning, and that the classroom community would also, you know, support that. I think, you know, students are in that environment are hopefully investigating like real world issues that are interesting to them, and working through an iterative process in building out a solution for that through programming and development for that. Yeah, I think that just about covers it. Collaborative, not quiet, interest-based, project-based, but interest-led, I guess, interest-driven.
So how do you help teachers realize that through professional development? And not just speaking of like Boot Up, this isn't like an advertisement for like the nonprofit we work for, but I mean, just broadly speaking, professional development in CS.
For me as a facilitator, I really like to make sure that teachers know that I used to be in their shoes, if not in a less knowledgeable place than they're in, you know, like, and I also like to model being a lead learner. Maybe I'm the expert in the room, but I'm not the expert, period. But I can help you find the answer if I don't know it, you know? And then I also think getting teachers connected to other teachers, whether it's in their school, in their grade, in their district, or just who have experienced the same thing in a context that's relatable to them, getting them connected so they can feel that support within an actual professional development, setting norms of everybody is here learning, we're all going to be vulnerable together, and, you know, nobody, it's a no judgment zone, right? Nobody's going to judge you for not knowing all the answers. Even I don't know all the answers. We're going to learn together. So, you know, modeling that community, I think, is important.
Yeah, I like that. So I want to zoom in even further. So we were just kind of talking about like the structure of support or the framework that you might provide. If we zoom in further and talk about the content. So like if somebody is an educator, maybe they've been teaching for a while, but they've never done CS in particular, what advice would you give to them to kind of help them learn more about the subject area or get started?
One idea that comes to mind is like maybe having a conversation with that teacher about like, tell me about something that is one of your favorite things to teach, and seeing if we can tie in like a basic, you know, computational thinking concept to that, you know, like, oh, you love to teach fractions. Let's talk about how fractions are a form of decomposition, you know, and get into that a little bit. So I feel like that's one approach that could kind of help CS be more approachable to that teacher.
All right. So I'm wondering if we can now zoom back out, thinking really big picture. So the entire state of Alabama, so you had the opportunity to assist with the standards development there. I'm wondering what's something that you learned through that experience?
That's a very, very technical process. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of people, but I learned when the state does a course of study, the state is giving districts the what, and the districts get to determine how they do it, right? So we give them the what, which is the standards. These are the bare minimum that you have to teach. And then the district gets to determine, you know, the curriculum or how they're going to actually teach the standards. I also learned like implementation rollout is interesting. So it started with high school for one school year, and then the next school year, middle school was required. And the next school year, elementary school is required. And they did that to help districts train teachers, right? So they have to have, you know, a CS trained teacher at that middle, at that high school to be able to offer that course to students. And same with middle and elementary. So it's divided out to make it easier for the districts to digest and implement properly, I guess. After the standards got adopted and everything, there's the whole committee like created professional development for districts to use to actually learn about the standards, what they mean, because they were so brand new, going from technology to being computer science.
Yeah.
Lots of jargon and concepts that used to intimidate me, you know? So just trying to make that something that is attainable to everybody. So modeling that equitable access.
Yeah, that was smart of the state to do that, because it's one thing to just like publish a document on your website and say, here you go, figure it out. It's another thing to actually go and provide some kind of support.
Something else that was cool that we did with this course of study that's unique, we decided since it's, you know, computer science and resources are always changing for that, we wanted to create a living resource hub for the teachers in the state. And I was able to co-create that with one of the other committee members. And so it was like a one-stop shop of, oh, you're teaching this standard, or you're trying to, you know, look for ideas for how to start integrating into your language arts block. Here's where you can go for that. And then, you know, professional development opportunities and professional learning communities. So all of that in a one-stop page. It's maintained by the state now, but I love that that's a resource that was created for that.
So I helped write the Wyoming curriculum. So I was like working with the 3-5 band, and it was an interesting process. They created a ton of resources that they ended up sharing after the fact, like to try and help support teachers and whatnot. But one of the things that I was constantly thinking through and discussing with my group was like the importance of language. So you had mentioned like that you decided the what and the teachers decide the how, like the districts figure out how they want to implement something. The way that you craft the standards can also have that kind of impact. So if you use language like identify X computer science concept or explain X computer science concept, that gets into the how of doing something rather than explore X computer science concept and whatnot. And you get to choose how you end up doing that. But if you get too granular with the verbiage, then it can be a form of colonization, which standards as a whole are still a form of colonization, which is something that I talked about in like the Pedagogy of the Press podcast that I did. And it was something that I was like constantly grappling with. Like, while I see the value in like setting a direction and like highlighting some things, it was still a form of colonizing ways of knowing or ways of being within the classroom. And it wasn't until I had some conversations with John Stapleton and some others, like, who pointed out like it's a beacon or a location that you can choose to go to or not. Like, you don't necessarily have to if they are not mandated. But I don't know if you had any like similar thoughts or concerns about like the standard process in general in relation to like, is this a form of colonizing?
I think that's a great point. I've never thought about it like that. I mean, that resonates with me. And what you said about the verbiage, I instantly got a flashback of the multiple conversations we had about, you know, Blooms and what we can use to say, can we use construct here? Am I allowed to say create, you know?
Right.
Lots of those. And you can't have any repeat in the same grade band, you know? And I mean, I would love to talk about that. I don't really have any insight on, you know, colonization and standards.
Yeah, it can be depending on how things are implemented. Like if it was, here's a guide, not a mandate, then that's very different than here's the thing that you have to do. And you have to spend like equal time on each one of these standards, et cetera. Like, there's many different approaches to it. And I've worked in districts where there were lesson plans that were mandated and you had to teach the same lesson as the other like 50 some odd elementary schools on the same week. And if you weren't, you'd get written up, et cetera. But then I've also been in districts where it's like, yeah, create whatever you want. Just as long as kids are learning, cool, go for it. So like the first one was definitely a form of colonization. My expertise was not valued. But then the second one, like I thrived in that situation, whereas other teachers were like, I have no idea what to do. I've never done programming. I've never taught it. I'm interested in it, but I don't know what to do. So trying to find that balance, or at least having those options for specific teachers and communities and students and whatnot, I think that's the key, in my opinion, how to provide support without mandating a form of colonization.
Yeah, I remember a conversation about, you know, mandating versus just having the standards. Is how are you going to mandate it? Are you going to fund it too?
Yeah.
You know, that's an equity issue as well. What about the poor school district, but then you have the super wealthy school district? They're going to have their teachers trained and, you know, by whoever.
Right.
They can get to come in, but then what about the rural place that doesn't even have good Wi-Fi, you know, or how are they going to successfully implement in the same way that other people are? What's interesting to me, you said that about lesson plans, like being scripted versus, you know, you go to another school district and you kind of just get, here's what we want you to teach, do it.
Mm-hmm.
That is also something that I noticed in my teaching journey across the spectrum. I feel like the school where I started teaching was inner city and Title I, and we had to write our own scripted lesson plans, but we had to like, here's what I'm going to say. Here's what the kids are going to say, you know, and turn them in every week for every single subject, all of that.
Yeah.
And then I go to a more affluent area and I'm trusted more as a professional to figure out what my kids need. And I feel like that's another huge equity gap too, because for me as a teacher, I don't want to stay in an environment where I'm going to have to write a script every week for every subject, you know?
Right.
So I'm going to look for another environment that I am not required to do that. But the reason that school was required to do that is because of failing test scores. And they have failing test scores because they're not funded properly. And they're not funded properly. You know, it keeps going. I kind of see it as like this unbreakable cycle or wheel, I guess, a wheel that doesn't break. And I want to break it.
Yeah, that first district that I was describing, they'd hand us like the curriculum that was a scripted lesson plan. And what we were supposed to do was add in our transition sentences and highlight those. Like it was literally a script of everything that we had to say and what we were going to do. And the PE department, they literally had I think it was actually a cassette at the time, but they had a recording, audio recording that they'd hit play on their boombox. And it would be the same delivery for everyone in the district. And the PE's teacher's role was to just walk around and like assist with technique and whatnot. But like the lesson was basically taught by an audio recording. So like they even took it one step further in the direction of colonizing or oppression on it. So you had mentioned an equity gap. I'm wondering if we could like zoom in on the equity gap and specifically talk about what kind of recommendations do you have for teachers who are interested in improving equity and inclusion in CS education?
I think that, you know, for it to be equitable, every kid has to be able to have the chance to explore it. And I kind of think of it like Dr. Jeff Gray, who taught me my very first computer science professional development. He is part of the reason why I've, you know, got the computer science bug or bug bite. I don't know. He made this analogy about how we all know how to drive a car. Not everybody knows exactly how everything works under the hood, but we have a special person who gets trained to do that, a mechanic, right? But we all drive for the most part or know how a car works in general, but maybe not the technicalities of it. And so I kind of feel like getting our students the option to be a driver or a mechanic, you know, but they have to be informed or have to have the option to explore CS to know if they like it enough to become a mechanic or if they just want to drive the technology they consume. So giving students that option to be not just a consumer of technology, but a creator, a producer. And then I also think including as much diversity as possible in CS content or in CS education. So, you know, having women, having people of color, having LGBTQ included into, you know, the videos you're showing your students about a computer scientist or, you know, researching different pioneers or having volunteers come in, and then the, you know, teachers themselves, can we be diverse in that too? Another thing I think is making sure that as much as possible, the content is relative. So, you know, I like to try to include real world scenarios or real world issues that, you know, real world computer engineers might be looking at to solve, and letting students kind of take it and run with it. It really gets them interested, or, you know, a problem they might be having at home or with school or something like that. Like, what can we do to troubleshoot that?
So you mentioned getting computer science into every grade level. Do you mean every grade level K through 12, or are you specifically focusing on like the elementary space in that answer?
I don't think it's unreasonable that CS be in every grade level. I think that might be something that is holding us back as a collective whole, is we're not starting young enough.
Right.
Not only solidifying their concepts of computational thinking, of computer science, but also of themselves and how they perceive themselves. You know, I was trying to find, before we got on here, I was trying to find the article about how students, like by the age of 4, I think, start to understand who they are and like their strengths. Like, I am a mathematician, I am not a writer. You know, so they start to think about those things. And then by the time they're in fourth grade, those start to solidify. Mm-hmm. So if we're waiting until middle school to introduce students to CS, that might be too late for some of them to even have a, even give themselves an opportunity to dig deep into CS and see if it's for them. Getting it down into kindergarten, I think, is just as important as having options for high schoolers.
Yeah, I like that. I definitely agree that CS should be available to everyone, K through 12. Where I kind of tend to diverge from the field is I don't think any subject area should be mandatory, like ever. Going back to a colonization standpoint, it's again colonizing certain ways of knowing. And to say you have to have X number of credits or X number of years in a subject area is imposing a way of thinking and being on people and valuing that I just disagree with. And I know that's not a popular opinion, but I mean, I'm just sharing, this is my honest thought. If somebody wants to learn something and they don't have the knowledge of it, but they have the desire to learn it, they're going to figure it out. They're going to learn how to do that thing. Just because they didn't have the prereqs to do it, they'll invest the time if they're actually interested in wanting to figure something out with the subject area. So from that, like when people say, yeah, but what about reading? What about mathematics? If they really want to learn something, there's a lot of studies that show that kids are going to learn it. Like, kids are learning scientific knowledge and learning how to read by playing the Pokemon card game, because they needed to know, what does super effective mean? What are those terms when looking at a game and being able to read other opponents' cards and stuff? So there's a lot of interesting research on that, and I try and point towards it, but I don't know. It's not a popular opinion among most people.
Well, I also think, you know, looking at how we do things out in the, you know, quote unquote real world versus how we do them in school, you know, I'm not taking English classes right now to be a computer science facilitator, you know, so this is what I'm interested in. I'm going to keep digging into that and learning that myself. I don't have somebody mandating to me, here's what you should be learning right now, other than the state making you, you know, do your CEUs for to keep your license as a teacher. But
yeah, like, so I'm recording instructional videos for drumming, since like that's my background. And part of the process that I've been engaging in for more than a year has been like improving my editing by learning from other people. And that didn't involve taking a course on it. I've never took a course on video editing. I'm learning how to do it through a bunch of resources. And if I had that opportunity to learn in school, I probably would have done it. That would have been cool. But what you were saying, like, James Paul G talks about this idea of like the portfolio selves and how everybody is getting to a point where individualized expertise in an area is so valued, but we are forcing this generalized understanding across like generic degrees and whatnot. And so a lot of people are graduating from high school or from university, and they have a similar understanding as their peers because they weren't encouraged to develop this expertise. But what employers are really looking for is the specific expertise. Hey, we want somebody who is the best at social media, not somebody who has a general understanding of communications. We specifically want this thing, not just basics.
Yeah. While we're not getting our kids ready for the jobs that are out there because they need more concentrated, specific skill set, I guess.
Right. And for him, like having taken a class with him, it's all about the lifelong learning. It's the most important thing that you can learn in school is how to learn. So like that's the thing that you absolutely need more than any required subject area, because then you can learn anything as long as you have the motivation to do it.
I think you and I have had the conversation before about like why I don't have a master's degree, you know, what I wanted to do and become an expert in. I never felt like I needed to meet the criterion of getting a master's. And I always worried that that would keep me from getting opportunities that my peers would get because they have a master's and I don't, but I have the same experience, if not more, you know?
Yeah, I think I spoke with you about it, but just to kind of share this with podcast listeners, I think that college degrees in particular tend to be overrated. And I know that sounds weird coming from somebody who does have a PhD. Like, it did enable me to do a lot of cool things that I could not do without that degree, but it doesn't mean that everyone should do it. Yes, I think everyone should engage in lifelong learning, but you don't need to go back and get multiple degrees and stuff. Like, for a while there, I was debating, should I get a CS degree? Because all my degrees are music education. And then I was like, well, I don't need one. I can learn all the things that I need to know about CS on my own, or I can take like a course if I really want to dive deeper into something, but it's mostly not as useful. The hard part is, okay, well, how do you assess the understanding of somebody in a field? And again, it goes back to like understanding the portfolio of what they bring to the table and really being able to zoom in rather than saying, oh, they have a degree in computer science or in music education or in whatever, so therefore they're qualified to do this thing. Well, maybe. I mean, maybe not.
Yeah. No, I love it. Like, I remember like the focus on GPA, you know, like when was the last time somebody asked you what your GPA was in college? Like,
yeah.
You know, or like, when was the last time somebody was like, hey, what criteria did you meet in high school to graduate? Like, tell me your courses that you had, you know?
Yep.
So it's kind of like we're putting all this pressure on our, you know, kids to, oh, you have to have all these things. This is what people are going to look for. Nobody cares about that stuff. Like, show me your skill set.
I've had a couple of conversations with different middle school kids who were like really stressed out. And they were like, I'm getting a lot of pressure because I'm not doing as great in this class and I'm afraid I won't get into college because of it. And I'm like, here's a secret. They're not going to look at your middle school transcripts. Like, yes, try hard, learn as much as you can, do as much as you can to learn everything you want to get out of this class and get the grade that you want to get. But they're not going to look at your transcript. So just breathe a little bit.
Yeah. Nobody's looking at your sixth grade stuff.
Yeah. I know some undergrads that I've seen, they'll sometimes share their resumes, like for when applying for jobs, they'd share it with like the university supervisors, like, hey, can you provide feedback on this? And sometimes they would include like stuff like, here's my GPA in middle school. And it's like, yeah, the employers aren't going to ask for that. It's nice that you have that information.
I'd be able to call in middle school and be like, hey, you remember back in the day?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's wild.
So one of the questions that I like to ask, what do you feel is holding back educators and what can we do about this?
I think I kind of touched on one of them about assuming that kindergarten's too young, assuming that fourth grade's too young to start in CS, which I feel like there's a huge push. We're starting to shift that perception. I just want it to happen faster. So getting those opportunities to students, you know, as young as kindergarten and not assuming that they're too young. I mean, podcast listeners probably know this too, but you know, you hand a 2-year-old an iPad and they're probably going to know what to do with it. Let's let them take it and run, but also make them go play outside.
Right.
I'm not saying give everybody a ton of screen time. I just think that they should have that exposure to see us.
I did an interview with Gail Lovely, who has done CS with pre-K. And so if anyone hasn't listened to that yet, I'll include that in the show notes so you can dive deeper into that area. But yeah, that definitely resonates. I agree with it. How do you practice or iterate on your own abilities, either as like as an educator or in your own understanding of computer science?
One way I like to iterate on my abilities is to watch other people in the field. So, you know, other professional development facilitators and, you know, kind of, you know, like I might hear somebody else explain abstraction in a way that I'm like, ooh, maybe that's more attainable than the example that I'm using, you know, and then having discussions with PLCs, even if it's my pocket of facilitators, like having those discussions about how can we, you know, make this better or make this more equitable or make this different. And then something that's hugely important to me is becoming more and more aware. You know, initially my perception of the gap in computer science was really limited. I thought, you know, it's like, oh, it's just, we need to get more women. There's just more and more nuances to inclusion that I am passionate about learning, you know? So every day is learning, you know, something you should say to be respectful or something you shouldn't to be inclusive. So just trying to navigate that and keep that in the forefront is huge too.
Yeah, on the first thing that you mentioned with watching somebody else teach and learning from them, that's one of the reasons why I started posting videos of my classes on my YouTube channel, because I'd present at conferences and talk about, oh, here's what it's like to facilitate multiple programming languages simultaneously. And they'd be like, yeah, but what does it look like? And so teachers would like literally come to my class just to observe, oh, that's what the space looks like. And I realized, oh, I can start recording it. And so YouTube has like an auto blur feature for faces. And so I'd use that function, and an admin was okay with that. And I'd share it. So like, hey, here's a playlist of what like four different classes look like of me facilitating this, just so that people can see, oh, this is how you can do more than one language in the same class at the same time. I wish more teachers in the field would do that, to share their practices. Like, we have people who have won like the Teaching Excellence in Computer Science Award from CSTA and Infosys Foundation, but like, what does that look like? It's great that these people are awesome educators, but I want to see them teach so I can learn from them.
And seeing it is much more powerful than trying to like read about it, you know?
Yeah.
I had people who won those awards and things like that, and they have to like describe their classroom. It's like, how do I put that into words? You know, how do I make sure that I'm not leaving anything out there?
I forget if it was that award or a different one that I won, but I didn't have to submit any video of myself teaching. And so it was all, how well can you write about how you teach? And I don't remember if it was that one or a different award, but it is just interesting. It's kind of telling of some teaching awards like that, where it's like, okay, but what are you assessing? Because it's not teaching if you don't actually see them teach.
Yeah. Oh, I thought of something for what kind of is holding us back. I think that it's hard for teachers, especially people who are not maybe brand new teachers, fresh out of college, because I feel like the pedagogy is shifting a little bit, where we're getting our teachers to be more facilitators in learning instead of standing up at the front of the classroom, like, here's what we're doing, here's what we're learning. That kind of teaching, where we're becoming facilitators. And I feel like that's a huge part of being successful in computer science, is kind of like allowing organized chaos. And that's not always a comfortable place for teachers.
Right.
And allowing yourself to not have every single answer. So I do think that kind of holds us back.
Yeah, I like that. I think teachers need to get more comfortable with being uncomfortable and not knowing. When I was in, it was probably elementary school, my parents had asked, oh, have you ever thought about being a teacher? And I was like, no, like, it seems like a boring job, because all you do is like, you have all the answers in your book, and all you're doing is just like reading off the questions. Like, I had this very simplified understanding of what it meant to teach as an elementary kid. But yeah, it's moving away from that idea and just going, oh, I don't know how to solve that bug. Let me try and figure it out with you, or let me get back to you tomorrow or something.
Yeah. And I think that's huge for students to see modeled too, you know, like,
yeah,
like I said, like lead learner, you know, you're still learning too with them, and
right,
you're the adult, and you know, they all think that their teachers are like 80 years old. So it's like, oh my God, they're still learning at 80.
Yeah. So you've gone above and beyond in terms of, you're not just doing classroom teaching. You've done a lot of professional development. You've done a lot of standards work. So you've added to your load of just working in the classroom, which is already hard enough in education. I'm curious, how have you tried to stave off the burnout that can come with doing so much in a difficult field?
The community is huge. I mean, staying around people that are passionate about the same thing that you are is huge, because then when your passion's kind of like, theirs maybe is the opposite, and they can pull you back up again. So I think, you know, having people that share the same jam as you is important. I also think it's huge. Like for me, I love computer science. I also love nature. So like getting away from screens and putting my eyeballs on things that are not made out of metal or or plastic and digital. That's been huge for me as far as avoiding burnout. I also feel like trying to find something different or new, fun to investigate. I remember a couple of years ago, I was kind of like, I mean, I've never been like, no, about computer science, but I was just kind of like, I'm not feeling the huge gung-ho passion that I was feeling. And I discovered a new accessibility tool for students who are visually impaired to be able to experience colors. And that kind of sparked my interest again, you know, so just finding things that are interesting, but also allowing yourself to take a freaking break.
Yeah.
Get off Twitter for a month or however long, you know, like, I mean, sometimes it's okay to just walk away. And that's not an easy thing to come across, especially because I feel like in our society, productivity is, you know, godly almost, and rest is revolutionary, you know? And so finding that balance, I think, is important.
Yeah, I'm still working on that.
Yeah.
It's a process. So what do you wish there's more research on that could inform your own practices?
I would love to know more about like the psychology of why our girls are not as innately interested as boys seem to be and that kind of thing. Like, I would love to hone in more on that because I feel like I've dabbled in that and I kind of know about it, but I want to get deeper in on that kind of thing.
Well, and why is it different in other locations? Like, there's a paper that I did, I think it was in Malaysia, and the numbers were flipped for male and female in the CS and IT space. Yeah. So it's cultural.
Yeah. Like, I would love to like study like societal trends, cultural acceptance, you know, that kind of thing. I think that's fascinating, not only in our, you know, computer science field, but just in general.
Yeah.
Why we do the things we do, what's programmed in us and what's actually us, you know?
Yeah. Even you look at other areas that we're also in, like education. Well, why is it that like 80%+ of teachers are white women?
Right.
Yeah. I also like looking at that. So that definitely resonates. But then I also wonder, like, why is it that some get more attention than others? Like, we don't talk about the gender issues in elementary teaching, but we talk about it in computer science. And it's like, well, why?
Right.
So then where might people go to connect with you and the organizations that you work with?
Yeah. Join me on Twitter. I'm at Wearing Whiz Kid. It used to be Wearing Whiz Kids when I had a classroom with students in it. And then I just decided to be the one Whiz Kid. But it's W-A-R-I-N-G. So come join me on there and, you know, DM me if you have questions. I'm happy to be a resource or be a resource to connect you with other resources. I used to be a CS for All Teachers community ambassador, and that's another great little virtual community that you can join into. So.
And with that concludes this week's episode of the CSK8 podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, I hope you consider sharing this with somebody else or leaving a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. Stay tuned next week for another episode, and until then, I hope you're all staying safe and are having a wonderful week.